or SOX, and several days after surviving some ratio of heart attacks to strokes that I am still not clear on because sometimes the details just get away from you. 3. SB visited my mom and swindled $10 from her roommate. He'd always had a way with the ladies. Even half dead, he was totally charming. 4. He was missing for 2 days. 5. They found him 3 miles from the nursing home. Cause of death, hypothermia. Dr. Weiss was on my father's emergency call list. He rode his bicycle through the streets of Chicago and Evanston all day and all night for 2 days, calling my father's name to no avail. No one comes to a junkie wino's funeral. Kara came, and I was so humiliated that we couldn't even have it in a church. Men like my father aren't eulogized by the well-respected ministers in their communities, and now she would know that about me when I'd tried so hard to construct this new self away from home. No one sent flowers. No one stood up to say a few kind words. There were drunks and hobos crowded around the entrance of the funeral home, a cloud of E&J brandy hanging over them as they tipped concealed pints of liquor out onto the sidewalk for their fallen brother. Dr. Weiss shyly introduced himself, and I felt another pang of embarrassment knife through my chest. Seeing him in that tiny red room in his bulky safety helmet, imagining him awkwardly questioning the dirtbags who hung out in the parking lots my father frequented and knocking on the doors of houses of ill repute, looking for this dude who kept letting him down again and again so that he could save his life one more time, made my chest constrict with longing. He said a few kind words about his old friend, and then, in a lilting and beautiful tenor, he sang the Lord's Prayer in Hebrew over my father's lifeless body. The room fell silent. I hadn't cried before then. I was too tired, too angry, too overwhelmed by what it meant now to have a dead parent, like the exotic new character introduced mid-season on a TV show. Dr. Weiss was singing with his eyes closed, and I felt my eyes flood with tears. For myself, for my mother, for Dr. Weiss. Sometimes I feel like I haven't stopped crying since. SB's ashes are tucked away in a box in a Gap bag inside my hall closet. The sheets and duvets within are decidedly unfolded. A case for remaining indoors. Wouldn't you rather be dead than hot? I am 100% over people pretending that open-mouth breathing in 1,000% humidity while being burned to a crisp by the sun is the jam. I prefer winter, when everyone has to be bundled beyond recognition to survive. Or fall, when you can wear something nice without sweating it sheer in the punishing heat. Too bad I can't afford to pack my one bag and move to the Arctic, because the minute I start seeing bare arms and booty shorts, my sad kicks in, and my happy doesn't return until late in September when, thank goodness, I can cover it up with a scarf. You dudes, frying under the sun at the beach, can't really expect the rest of us to believe that you enjoy painfully peeling your seared flesh from plastic chairs while everyone in the restaurant is staring at the armpit stubble revealed by your tank tops, can you? I'm not hating. It's just that I'm baffled when these hot weather enthusiasts try to convince you how totally awesome it is to be standing around outside in air that's as thick as soup, while trying to pick the char off smoldering ribs and hot dogs, while gingerly clutching a beer that won't stay cold. Would it be so bad if we ate this inside, at a table that is sturdy, where no flies can vomit on my plate while I'm trying to balance it on my knees? It is a cloudless 72 degrees in Chicago today. The sun is blazing in the sky. I closed the blinds when I finally woke up around 1:30 in the afternoon. Birds are chirping sweetly in the trees. I shut the windows. And people are crowding the streets in droves celebrating this long-awaited break in the dreary gray spring weather. I assume. Like I said, I shut the goddamn windows and blinds. I'm going to take a shower and order a grocery delivery, then maybe stare at the wall until it's time to go back to bed. If I went outside, I could walk down the street to the beach, stroll along the lake path, and get bit by a dog. Suffer through an awkward conversation with someone who lives in this neighborhood, someone I will now be forced to avoid until the end of time. Watch children beating each other with sticks while enjoying the fresh air. Soak up some vitamin D and also harmful UVA and UVB rays. Get the perfectly acceptable to wear again tomorrow clothes I'm wearing, all sweaty and gross. On the flip side, in my apartment, I can eat the rest of this box of cereal dry by the fistful. Look at people outside without having to smell them or listen to their opinions. Organize my ketchups. Write song lyrics for my easy listening band, Queasy Listening. Words like outdoor music festival are why I am so glad summer in Chicago lasts approximately 7 minutes. I nearly wept tears of seasonal affective disordered joy as I pulled out my North Face boots at the end of last November. As good as the warm air feels on my immobile joints, I can't help but love winter and fall. Mostly fall, because fuck snow, and that hawk blowing off the lake is enough to make your teeth drop right out of your skull. But winter can be kind of okay if it doesn't snow a whole lot and no one asks me to go sledding or do some other Hallmark movie nonsense. The more sweaters and scarves I can wrap around my head, the better. Summer can be an exercise in torture, but not an exercise in actual exercise, duh, because it's too humid. If you don't want to do crazy shit like wear sleeveless shirts or enjoy close proximity to actively sweating strangers. One summer, I walked by these dirty hipsters at Division Fest, the kind of outdoor food and music festival that sounds like fun in theory until you actually get there and find yourself eating an overcooked hot dog while standing in a curdled pool of someone else's puke, dancing in a large gray puddle of used tampons and diarrhea, and thought miserably, I hope you guys catch something incurable. I was instantly burning with hatred for those people, dancing with their mouths open in a shallow pool of urban toxic waste. And the band they were dancing to wasn't even that jamming. I never have to go outside again because, one, my boyfriend, the television, is inside. Have you heard of those thunder shirts for dogs to help them stay calm during loud storms? They should be made for people to help us stay calm in situations when we have to listen to someone explain at great length why they are too busy to own a TV set. Picture it. You're chilling in the corner at a party full of people you've never met before and hated on sight, humming the lyrics to a Coldplay song to yourself to drown out the Swedish death metal the hostess put on to prop up her apparition of coolness. Then here comes some asshole who makes her own yogurt and just discovered Ta-Nehisi Coates, condescending at you about how damaging reality shows are to impressionable youth. Man, I fucking love TV. And I don't mean educational programming on PBS or crackly documentaries about important historical figures. I mean, I know all of the cast members of The Real Housewives of Atlanta, past and present, and all of their children, pets, and significant others by name. I once walked blindly past my own sister on a sparsely populated train platform on a Saturday afternoon, but I could tell you who won Survivor the last few seasons without even having to Google it. Television has forever been my unwavering companion and trusted friend. Every bad day, every breakup, every inexplicable 2 a.m. awakening, television has been there for me through all of them. I would trade every deadly hornet sting and itchy eye-causing spring bloom without hesitation for the warm glow of my Samsung for the rest of my life. 2. Are there enough blazers in my closet? Years ago, I decided that I was going to be a jacket person. I'm not sure it was a conscious decision, like I didn't just wake up one day and throw out all my long-sleeve shirts, but I remember finding this insanely well-cut crop denim jacket with a military collar and cinched waist, and the first time I wore it, I didn't take it off for the entire day. At some point the next morning, stumbling around hungover and bleary-eyed trying to get my shit together for work, it dawned on me that I could just wear that jacket again. I already knew it looked good, and anyone paying close attention would just assume I'd changed the t-shirt I'd worn underneath, so why the fuck not? I put that damn jacket on every single day. If Michael Kors could wear the same uniform every day, why not Samantha Irby? Now I have all kinds of jackets, leather ones, tweed ones, twill ones, the works. And you would not believe how many pajama pants you can get away with wearing to nice places if you just slap a sharply cut blazer on top of them. I went to a party recently at the Museum of Contemporary Art, and I almost took an anxiety shit in the charcoal Spalding women's bootleg yoga pant I just ripped out of the plastic Amazon packaging after gazing at all the angular haircuts and avant-garde outfits teetering around on sky-high heels, their delicate ankles bound by complicated-looking straps. I was wearing a baggy V-neck riddled with holes from moths and actual wear and tear, but I had gotten my nicest blazer from the dry cleaner, so even though I felt wildly out of place, between the blush I'd put on in the cab and the jacket my dry cleaner starched the shit out of, I felt okay enough to hang out for an hour before demanding my homeboy drive me home. Home, where I can gaze lovingly at my closet and organize my jackets. By color, by material, by the likelihood they will ever see the outside world. I'm sitting in my crib right now, listening to this Gretchen Parlato record from 3 years ago, ripping sheets of toilet paper off the roll I keep on my desk because buying boxes of Kleenex feels like a waste when allergy season is about to destroy my life anyway, and I am wearing a jacket, a black pleather motorcycle jacket I got for sale at ASOS that has a little fringe on it, but not so much that I look like I'm going to an Aerosmith cover band audition later. That's the thing about being an inside person who enjoys the occasional wardrobe splurge. You gotta be cool with modeling it for the cat and hoping the delivery dude from a part pizza company assumes you just got home from work. You are so busy writing checks and taking important calls that you hadn't had time to shrug it off before opening the door for your pizza. Even though you both know deep down that you haven't left the apartment all day and only put the jacket on because it's a shame to let an $80 coat go unworn. 3. Food just tastes better inside. White people love picnics. So much, in fact, that they'll stop just about anywhere to have one. Why? Everywhere you look, someone has turned a bus bench or a statue or a filthy curb into an outdoor cafe. You dudes just stop and bust out your wicker baskets anywhere, hmm? I know my people love a summertime cookout as much as anyone, but we don't just set up a three-legged grill in the alley next to the dumpster as soon as the winter snow melts and throw our chicken on it. We organize. We plan. First of all, we need to know who is going to be responsible for the potato salad. You can't just let that one lady from work you invited to be nice bring hers. It has to be known potato salad from a vetted and reliable source. I can't even commit to going to a white person's house for dinner in the summer unless we have specific plans to do something that requires four walls and a roof while I pretend to be picking at their homemade tabbouleh. because guaranteed I'm going to walk into the house and be greeted with, "Hey, let's eat this out on the patio." And by patio, they mean that little scrap of cement at the base of my back stairs that holds only one chair and is right next to the trash. LOL, fuck that. And I try to avoid restaurants with outdoor seating at all costs, especially with my non-melanotic friends. Because when your Uber driver makes a wrong turn and they beat you to the place by a hair, they always do some slick shit, like put your name in for an outside table. I don't care how long the wait is. I'd rather wait an hour for a table that won't get covered in pigeon shit and the airborne pathogens expelled from the mouths of curious passers-by. 4. You can daydream about things in catalogs you are never going to buy. Without fail, I get the IKEA catalog every single year. Let me remind you that I currently live in a space that contains this many things. A full-size bed, a television on top of a television stand, a stack of magazines next to the bed that used to hold a small fan, and my BiPAP machine, because finding a bedside table seemed like too much work. A desk whose resale value I just today discovered I ruined with a broken bottle of nail polish. A large air conditioner currently sitting on the floor beneath the window. A table my friend's dad made that I keep in the dining room to hold wine bottles and plants. A stainless steel shelving unit that serves as an open-air concept pantry, I roll. A dresser whose bottom two drawers I am terrified to open. A bookshelf I have inexplicably moved 6 motherfucking times. 1 chair. There's other shit in here. Laptop, house phone I no longer remember the number to, prosperity candles from the occult bookstore. But it doesn't count, since those are things that go on top of other things. Suffice it to say, I have no reason whatsoever to be comparing backsplashes. I have been a renter my entire life. My home improvement joy is firmly grounded in novelty items, like matching clothes hangers and interesting dish towels, affordable splashes of color and beauty that can liven up this space that's crumbling at the corners and painted like a prison cell. The idea of owning a home feels stressful to me, like, if the toilet breaks and it's not my paycheck week, am I really going to have to shit at the gas station for 9 days until my direct deposit clears? Yes. Also, I don't understand how mortgages work other than a handful of scenes I can remember from The Big Short. And don't quote me on this, but I'm pretty sure Steve Carell told me the dumbest thing I could ever do is sink my regular person money into any type of real estate. Let someone else take the risk, and I can relax and waste the money I should be putting into a savings account on decorative pillows and champagne flutes I'll never use. But catalogs are a miracle, because you can design your very own dream house with none of the risk or expense. I'm like a little girl with my post-it notes and red Sharpie. I want the farmhouse sink and these marble countertops and a butcher block island in the center of the kitchen. These brass sconces would look good in the master bathroom, and definitely some track lighting in the family room. And ooh, wouldn't this leather sofa look amazing in the den? I could spend an entire weekend locked in a 500-square-foot studio apartment, circling armoires in the Crate and Barrel catalog that will never see the inside of any place other than my brain. I like to pull all the Bed Bath & Beyond coupons out of the Sunday paper and stick them in a drawer for the day I decide to stop living like a trash person and buy sheets with an impressive thread count. One of these days I'm going to move to a place in which a footstool might not look out of place, and I'm going to need that 20% off, okay? 5. Your space, your rules. Now, this is assuming that you haven't made the fatal mistake of trying to be inside at some place other than the one in which you live. People who don't understand that my writing process consists of staring sullenly at my computer, waiting for the jokes to come, while willing myself not to get up to re-examine the contents of the almost bare refrigerator I just took stock of 10 minutes ago, often ask if I like to write in coffee shops. I used to, especially before I caved and got a high-speed internet hookup in my casa. Sometimes I'd roll down to the Heartland to pick at a bowl of vegan chili and soak up their internet, but then my favorite bartender quit and they took the black bean nachos off the menu, so bye. There are a handful of coffee shops in Edgewater that feel cozy and relaxing, but the problem with that is I am never cozy or relaxed. Even with headphones on, I could never get over the idea that someone was watching me, that they knew I had a deadline or a draft due, and noticed that instead of putting my head down and working, I'd spent the entire time glancing around wondering what everyone else was working on. And I live near Loyola University, so the answer was probably definitely a term paper for Indigenous and settler colonialism. But still, I'd sit there with my laptop open to a blank page waiting to be filled with at least 4,500 words on the scintillating topic of my anus, wondering what the girl with the blue hair and hand tattoos had picked as her major. I would pack up my computer and the book I like to carry in case I got frustrated with the writing, and grumble as I banged out the door, take the train a few stops to a place with quality scones and iced tea, then sit there for hours paralyzed with fear that if I drank too much, I would have to go to the bathroom and be faced with the dilemma of whether someone would steal a computer cheaper and more busted than theirs for the 3 minutes I was gone. I am unfamiliar with coffee shop etiquette. Since I let the dude texting across from me hog the outlet, is he morally obligated to make sure no one runs off with my wallet while I'm in the can? If I take my wallet, will he keep an eye on my laptop? And what about my bag? I am anxious, and I don't trust anyone, and would also never want to burden a stranger with my literal shit. But I had to buy a drink to get the Wi-Fi password and didn't want to look like a cheapskate, so I got the big one and a donut. And now I have to pee, but I'm not ready to leave, and Jesus God, what can I do? So I would take everything in with me, a mess of tangled cords spilling from my shoulder bag, my unfinished teacup balanced precariously in the hand, not fumbling for my phone. I usually could manage to pee without letting my cup touch any contaminated surfaces, and when I emerged from the bathroom, someone new would inevitably be sitting in my seat, unsheathing her gleaming MacBook Pro from its protective case, nodding with a smile at the outlet hog as he unplugged so she could use it. Defeated and deflated after multiple days sulking home with my work undone, I finally called RCN to come connect whatever wires I needed to get the fastest possible mature lesbian porn on my phone. I can make my own tea. Better yet, I can smoke a bowl and drink an entire pitcher of Crystal Light and finish that butthole essay in my nicest house jacket and take as many breaks as I want. And no one is going to steal my seat when I get up for a cookie refill or cause me to break out in a sweat when my battery is at 7% and the nearest outlet is in use. I won't get sucked into watching a young man artfully arrange his latte and muffin just so for the gram. No eavesdropping on conversations about bands I've never heard of and am too uncool to understand. No nervously asking an irritated barista what Sumatra means. Just me and the cat and the bags of Lipton I shoved in my pocket at work because buying an actual box of tea in real life feels like a ridiculous, unnecessary thing. It's fucking perfect. Be right back. Gotta go pee. A total attack of the heart. The first time I had the kind of anxiety attack that makes you feel like you're going to die, I was standing next to a friend's car in the parking lot of a combination gas station and subway. I tossed my sandwich onto the passenger seat and pawed at my chest while trying to catch my breath. What a fucking terrible place to die, I thought. surrounded by cab drivers shouting unintelligibly into Bluetooth headsets, and people in wheelchairs from the nursing home down the street rolling up to buy candy bars and beer. I assumed I was having a heart attack because I had been in line at Subway behind three of my people, each of whom had a long list of complicated instructions for the sandwich artist tasked with preparing his evening meal. Since we can't get reparations, we will make it up in toppings. I want provolone cheese and cucumbers and spinach and lettuce and red onions and tomatoes, olives and banana peppers, and jardinera. I need the Chipotle Southwest sauce and the ranch and extra meat, but I don't want you to charge me for it. Also, let me get the green bell peppers and the herbs and spices, oil and vinegar too, on the Italian herbs and cheese bread. Then I want you to toast that shit, but don't, like, toast it. It's nerve-wracking. Please just let me get my plain scoops of tuna on wheat bread before I sweat through my clothes with anxiety over this transaction not turning out the way you intended. Because most of those things don't even go with meatballs, but what the fuck do I know? God, just let me leave. It took less than 2 minutes to get to my place, and I spent the entire car ride wondering whether my outfit looked good enough for my ghost to float around in for an eternity. I got off the elevator in my building and stood in place, gasping like I'd just run a marathon, and I felt this weird pain radiating from my left shoulder down my arm and into my hand, and the crushing realization that now I was going to die in a hallway that doesn't get vacuumed often enough before the next Game of Thrones book comes out made me dizzy with rage. After struggling to get the key into the lock, I finally stumbled into my apartment and collapsed on the bed, gulping air and wondering if the paramedics would keep my dying with a foot-long tuna sub crammed into my mouth a secret. Seriously, I for real thought I was having a motherfucking heart attack, and while balanced precariously on the precipice of death, my biggest concern wasn't life insurance or whether my toilet had been bleached or if I had time to write a list of who would get my worthless belongings. It was, should I take a bite of these tuna fishes before they get slimy or nah? I spend an inordinate amount of time fantasizing about death. Not normal shit, like wondering if heaven is real, no, and if my parents have reunited there to continue that one argument from 1983 over the light bill, probably. But about how and when and what I'm going to be wearing when it finally comes for me. You would think that someone this preoccupied with dying would take better care of her plants and apartment, but nope. I prefer instead to lie awake, petrified that I'm not going to wake up, and that whoever finds the stinking meat suit rotting away in my two-week-old sheets is going to know I was too lazy to wash off my mascara before I went to sleep. Sometimes I feel ready to die, like when I have to sit through the painful, drunken, rambling toasts at a wedding, or when a stranger accidentally grazes my skin with his visibly dirty, overgrown fingernails. But other times I think I need to stick around longer because I haven't gotten to see Ben Affleck as Batman yet, or had a really good pineapple upside-down cake since the ones my mom used to make. I really do think about dying every day, though. Sometimes I think about what would happen if the electricity in my brain just suddenly shut off, like a light switch. Like, what if I was just sitting there watching that same Mike Epps comedy special I always watch? Does Netflix track that? Is someone in a windowless Silicon Valley office counting that I have watched Mike Epps' Underrated and Never Faded 237 real times? While unbeknownst to me, a giant clot was creeping its way from behind my knee up to my lungs. Somebody from work, pissed off that I've missed so many shifts, is going to find my dead body next to a pile of dried up baked beans I had been eating in the dark out of the can. In a robe I didn't even bother to cinch shut because who the fuck is even here? I would be dead in my fancy black robe, tits splayed, tomato sauce congealed in the corners of my mouth, as Netflix asks judgmentally, "Are you still watching this?" If you are the person who happens to find me, please at least switch the television to something educational before you call the police. I turned on Family Feud. If I gotta die, I want to be watching something wholesome in case I'm wrong about the heaven thing. And called my number one call in an emergency, especially if I think I'm dying friend, Carl, who is a total idiot in most instances, but dude has been a paramedic supervisor for 10 plus years, so I figured I could defer to his judgment. He'd talked me through a couple of bug bites and mysterious rashes previously with mostly satisfactory results. Before I even finished describing my symptoms, he was like, call an ambulance. Slow down, homie. Having an ambulance come to rescue me from the warm embrace of death is my biggest fear, other than whether the people who deliver my takeout are secretly judging how many quarts of soup I order every week. I assume that everyone is as simple as I am, and if I were an EMT, while my main objective would be to save a dying person's life, I would definitely notice the overflowing cat box in the corner of your bathroom as you writhed on the carpet, clutching at your throat while trying not to die. Sure, I'd put out the grease fire threatening to engulf your whole kitchen, but only after Firefighter Sam paused for a second to check out the spines on those haphazardly arranged books on your shelf. I might need a suggestion for book club. I glanced at the pile of Land's End catalogs I'd tossed into the laundry basket full of balled-up socks and possibly an empty McDonald's bag. Not doing that, I gasped into the phone, feeling the cold grip of death wrapped around my lungs grow tighter. I texted my sister Carmen, and after she picked me up, I instructed her to please drive me to the good emergency room. I'm not kidding. If I gotta die, that's fine. It just has to be at a hospital with individual rooms and satellite television. So we left the car with the valet. I told you guys, this place was dope. And checked in at the desk, where they pulled my chart up instantly. It's not my intestines this time. I am definitely dying, I wheezed at the receptionist. Do you still have United Healthcare? She asked dryly, never once glancing away from the computer screen. And I tried to explain with my eyes that I, too, know the agony of manning a desk where I am expected to facilitate care for inconsiderate jerks. I nodded and slid the flimsy plastic card across to her with the hand that wasn't clutching the invisible knife wounds in my chest. She pointed to a chair in the waiting room and told me to wait for triage. "Aren't you having a heart attack?" Carmen asked, looking up from a magazine as I approached. I shrugged and slumped in a chair next to her while apologizing to the air for those Little Debbie oatmeal pies I stole from the corner store when I was a kid. What if there is a hell, okay? A dude with a black eye and severed thumb he held against his hand with a dish towel sat down across from us. My heart was seconds away from stopping, and homeboy's thumb was indisputably detached from his hand, and they had us just sitting out here with all the stomach aches and bee stings. A tech came to get me, guiding me through a crowd of influenza and broken arms to a small room in the back. He explained that the hospital was undergoing some construction and that he'd be administering my echocardiogram in this closet while I sat in a recliner. There were no ill-fitting gowns, no drawers full of gauze, no dispenser full of crinkly blue vomit bags. I took off my shirt so he could try to affix electrodes under my sweaty boobs, then sat in the recliner and closed my eyes while trying to picture something relaxing. The tech suggested a beach in Tahiti. But I hate the beach, that dirty sand getting in all your moist cracks and bugs feasting on your sunburned skin. So instead, I focused on something that would actually calm me. One of my enemies choking on a salad. 20 minutes later, I was in a real room with a bed. My sister Jane, who'd met us in the waiting room, next to me yammering into her phone. The doctor pulled back the curtain and gave me one of those condescending, sad smiles. The kind you give a child who says 2 + 2 = 7 and believes it. Apparently, I hadn't had a heart attack. No, instead of life-threatening cardiac event, the reading on the EKG came out not right emotionally. Not kidding, all those lines and squiggles on that mile-long piece of tape spelled out the words mentally ill like an electric Ouija board. Did you know that a panic attack can feel just like a heart attack? I didn't, but I learned that shit quick as the phlebotomist jammed an IV into my arm and the doctor loaded a big dose of Ativan into my veins and knit his eyebrows together with concern while batting around words like therapy and anxiety. When I have a panic attack, my throat closes up like someone has a big, meaty hand clasped around it, and my chest hurts and I can't breathe, and I become 100% certain that I'm going to wither and die right then and there. I know when you feel it coming on, you're supposed to relax and do the breathing exercises your very sensible doctor taught you. But it feels like if I lie down or close my eyes for even a second, I will never open them again. And most of the time, I'm down with that. But this shit always happens when my sheets need changing or my garbage can is full of freezer-burned Hot Pockets I tried to salvage. And I get even more stressed out at the thought of whoever finds my corpse discovering the last thing I Googled was Shark Tank bonus clips. Not being able to deal with your life is humiliating. It makes you feel weak. And if you're African American and female, not only are you expected to be resilient enough to just take the hits and keep going, but if you can't, you're a black bitch with an attitude. You're not mentally ill, you're ghetto. Sitting in that hospital bed, talking with a dude who was fresh out of medical school and looked like he was playing doctor with his father's stethoscope looped around his neck, I was so fucking embarrassed, ashamed to be talking to him about being so mad and so sad most of the time, letting Rosa Parks and Harriet Tubman down by talking about my silly little feelings. I was born to one of those mythical black hero women, a single mother who somehow managed to graduate both high school and a nursing program despite having had her first child at 16, a woman I never saw pop a pill or take a drink or bury her head under a pillow for 3 days at a time. Every single time I just can't get up, I beat myself up a little because it's not like I have children or a job I hate. And there's probably nothing the matter with me other than laziness. When I was growing up, no one in my house was talking about depression. That's something that happened to white people on television, not a thing that could take down a strong black woman. Which also destroyed me on the, why are you listening to Smashing Pumpkins instead of, insert name of popular early 90s R&B artist, are you even black level? So I was, one, super fucking depressed. Two, super fucking depressed with no one to talk to about it who wasn't going to immediately suggest child services remove me from my home. And three, super fucking depressed while clocking in on the low end of my skin folks' negrometers because I identified hard with Courtney Love and read Sassy Magazine because Essence wasn't really speaking to me yet. So wasn't this whole thing yet another way I was desperately trying to be white? When I was young, I was frequently described as moody or dismissed as angry. According to the social worker who routinely pulled me out of class, I was intellectually bright but quietly hostile. Never mind that I was basically living in squalor with my mother's half-dead corpse, subsisting on the kind of cereal that comes in a 5-pound bag and whatever nutrient-rich meals were being served for free hot lunch. I was diagnosed as having an attitude problem. The black girl curse. So I rocked with that. When you're a kid, it's sometimes just easier to go along with other people's definitions of who you are. They're adults, right? So they're smarter? I would listen to this Faith No More tape on my Walkman. Do young people understand what those words even mean? Over and over, while sulking and looking morose, or whatever it is poor kids get to do when we have no access to semi-automatic firearms or prescription drugs. It was the only thing I could do to make it to the next goddamn day. I tried to take my own life in 1993, and the general response when it failed was basically, LOL, toughen up. My first semester freshman report card. English, C. History, C. Gym, D. Band, B+. Algebra, A. Because Kate Lewis helped me do my homework. I love you, Kate. Suicide, F. I just slept straight through the rest of the weekend and went back to school the next Monday. I kept doing the same shit I'd always been doing and figured that if I wanted to try again, I needed to wait until I was old enough to get a car and drive it off one of suburban Chicagoland's many cliffs. I think my mom started watching me a little more closely, but what was she really going to do? She was severely disabled. My being hopeless all the time was trumped by, you know I can't walk, right? And I get that. I was a kid, and it was my job to go to school, so I did my job. I would deal with it when I was off Medicare and making enough money to pay for cognitive therapy myself. Even when my fucking parents died in 1998 and I had an actual thing I could point to as a source of my unrelenting depression, a cause to substantiate the effect of my simmering hatred, I played it off. I don't know if it feels like this for anyone else, but I definitely come from the kind of people whose response to, hey man, I'm pretty bummed out, is shut up, there's nothing wrong with you. Or how about, you just sleep all the time because you're lazy. Like, if it isn't broken or hemorrhaging, you need to bury it under these dollar store snack foods and work it out by your fucking self. Oh, okay, cool. So then I developed very glamorous coping mechanisms, like covering myself with grisly death tattoos and eating food out of the trash. And then, because I wasn't actively trying to kill myself and could keep a job and make friends and pay my rent and not do heroin, I made peace with it. This is just how I am. I'm fine. For as long as I can remember, I've had this undercurrent of sadness that, if I'm being honest, I don't totally mind. It was easy to ignore because it doesn't bother me that much. And I don't want to be some shiny, happy idiot. This is gritty. This is real. One of my most favorite extracurricular activities these days is taking a Klonopin. But not just taking it. Also making a big production of getting up to get the water, then swallowing it and looking up potential side effects that I really don't give a shit about, yet am mildly terrified might actually occur. I would like to meet the person who gets a medication to fix a for real fucking problem and is like, hold up, appetite changes? Unacceptable, Dr. Dude. And then, like, dramatically flushes all the pills down the toilet before collapsing into an anxiety-ridden stress puddle. I will take anything, at any time, if a doctor tells me it will repair whatever is wrong with me in that instant. Maybe I'll read about it if I have to spend a little extra time on the toilet, but that definitely happens after I've already swallowed the pills dry and set a timer to see how quickly they start working. I will also take any combination of NyQuil, antihistamines, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, vitamins, and assorted syrups at the first sign of a weepy eye or scratchy throat. To hell with my liver. Fix this. I am just an old garbage bag full of blood, patiently waiting for death to rescue me. But sometimes when I tell people that, their immediate response is, how can you be sad? You're hilarious. And then for 5 seconds, I'm like, this person who has never met me before is correct. I'm so funny, I should stop thinking life is a trash can. But 5 seconds after that, some human roadkill yells at the grocery store bagger or pulls his scrotum out on the train, and I get the insatiable urge to peel my skin off like the layers of an onion and jam my thumbs into my eye sockets, just hoping that I'll disappear down the garbage disposal of human existence straight into hell. Then it's easy to just write the depression off as an irritation at the dummies I have the misfortune of sharing the planet with. I'm not depressed. Dudes who ride unicycles in rush hour traffic are fucking idiots. Or, nothing is wrong with me. The real problem is all these people mindlessly texting while their dog shit in the middle of the goddamn sidewalk. Two things happened that forced me to finally have the sometimes I have a disproportionately rage-filled response to otherwise harmless shit talk with my doctor. One, I was at work and the worst person in the world came in to buy dog food. This is the kind of person who asks an unending stream of questions that I, as an unfamiliar customer service representative, couldn't possibly answer as she empties the entire contents of her handbag onto the counter in front of me. I hate that. The please don't write a negative Yelp review of this business trap that requires my standing there trying to look engaged while this woman uses me as a sounding board for questions like, is, redacted, going to eat 3 cans, or should I just get one? She's not asking me, but she's not asking me. I mean, we're making eye contact and everything, but how could I know? And I had to wait there held hostage because one of these questions, pouring like vomit from her toothless maw, might be one I can actually answer. I felt the familiar rage heat claw its way slowly up my neck and into my jaw before finally scratching at the backs of my eyeballs. And as she kept rambling nonsensically to herself while pretending she needed my help for 5 minutes in real time, I calmly raised my hands to my ears and used my forefingers to hold them closed and said, "You have to get the fuck out of here or I will destroy you." So much for that stellar Yelp review. My panic attacks usually don't have any obvious triggers. The last time I was hospitalized for a bad one, I'd had a surprisingly good day. Brunch with a friend at M. Henry, a field trip to the metaphysical bookstore for smudge sticks and oils, back home in bed watching eyeliner tutorials on YouTube for the rest of the afternoon. Bills paid, snacks in the fridge, clean clothes folded and put away, and then bang. Pain I couldn't ignore, snaking up my left arm before encircling my heart and squeezing it so hard I thought I was going to faint. I remember thinking to myself, "Chill out, bitch, you know what this is." But you know how that goes. I just freaked out harder and tried to breathe and get my shoes on, but every breath felt like an ice pick to the center of my chest and I couldn't lace them up. I called an Uber, then sat in my lobby wearing headphones and disgusting Crocs, and when the car arrived, I tried to say hello as cheerfully as possible so I wouldn't tip the driver off. The emergency room was slow that night, and they saw me right away and talked to me in their most soothing voices. I got some x-rays and a CAT scan, and when the doctor came in to tell me my heart was enlarged, I asked, "Is it because I love too much?" And we both had a hearty laugh before he was like, "Stop eating meat," and put through the order for me to be admitted and hooked up to a ventilator for 2 days. All this might be easier if I could punch something, but I'm not a punch something person. I must sit in the dark in the bathroom with a package of sharp cheddar cheese slices person. Except I don't even really eat cheese anymore. Plus, I can't fight. I'm soft, man. And I don't have any answers. The world is scary and terrible, and people out here don't want Obamacare to fix a paper cut, let alone offer some discounted mental health care. So what is left for us to do? Talk about it? Stop being afraid of it? Shut down those who want to dismiss us as fragile or crazy. I went on Lexapro, but after 3 weeks I had stopped sleeping and fuck that. Maybe it doesn't work that way for everyone, but I'd rather be angry and well-rested than tired and happy. Or quote-unquote happy, I guess. I have pills that make me sleepy instead of panicky. And I learned how to do this 4-7-8 breathing technique that's supposed to switch your body from fight or flight to a passive response. But come on. Seriously, the only time it even occurs to me to do it is when I'm already sweating and trying to dry swallow some of these benzos. Do black girls even get to be depressed? If I ever have more than $37 in my pocket, I'm going to open a school for girls with bad attitudes where we basically talk to therapists all day while wearing soft pants and occasionally taking a field trip to the nearest elote cart. And if that doesn't work, I'll just tell some more stupid jokes. Good thing I'm hilarious. A civil union. I witnessed a civil war reenactment once. And that is a straight-up miracle, considering I had absolutely no idea that people in the North even participated in that kind of thing. Having grown up in this liberal North Shore enclave where no one blinks an eye at your liberal gay blackness, I sometimes forget that the minute you jump on 355 heading west, Illinois becomes an entirely different place. A place where mullets are still fashionable and fanny packs are considered an acceptable accessory. My homie was getting married on a gorgeous Saturday afternoon in Naperville, because that is where he is from, and that is where his parents still live. And would it kill one of my idiot friends to marry some asshole who could afford to throw a wedding downtown? But I love him, so I had to go. After waking up at noon and dragging myself out of bed, the first thing I thought was, shit, I totally forgot to buy nude pantyhose. I'm going to look so out of place around these sensibly shoed people. Deciding who to drag with you to a wedding when you're unattached is a tense circle of hell situation for real, especially if it's a church wedding and you have the type of friends who might burst into flames upon entry. I made my friend Amy go with me, promising that I would sit through her traveling folk metal band's next show in Chicago, but secretly hoping I would die before the time came to make good on that promise. When I went downstairs to meet her, carrying my reusable grocery bag with nice shoes, makeup, and one of those inner thigh chafe sticks in it, I stopped cold. Amy, my beloved tomboy, typically clad in trucker hats and fitted tank tops and baggy ripped jeans from the boys section at Target, was wearing a dress. My sweet, sweet Amy, 5 feet tall and built like a Lego, was wearing daytime sequins. It looked like someone had stretched an ice skating costume over a refrigerator box. I gasped. She put the cigarette she was smoking out between her fingers and tried to twirl her sparse mustache, the octopus tattooed on her partially shaved scalp shining in the sunshine. My tux is at the dry cleaner, so I'm wearing my old prom dress, she said by way of explanation. And I put my head down to keep from laughing as I went to toss my stuff in the back seat. This was the only nice thing I had, she wailed, and I basically almost choked. As Amy's grumbling, oversized truck belched a steady stream of greasy, blue-gray smoke from its exhaust, she took my hand to help hoist me up, then climbed over me like a toddler to get into the driver's seat. We peeled out with a screech, Ice Cube bumping from the brand new speaker she'd proudly installed herself. Naperville is a relatively wealthy and predominantly Republican suburb a little over an hour outside of Chicago, and I knew I was in trouble the minute I saw how many churches we were driving past as we exited the tollway. Seriously, it was like church, church, Burger King that whole families actually sit down and eat dinner in, church, church, Walmart, church. We saw at least 137 churches in a 2-mile stretch, and that was only after I'd actually started counting them. Despite having stayed at least 10 miles over the speed limit the entire trip, we arrived late to the ceremony. Blame CVS for not having any good wedding cards and for putting the generic Aleve too far from the Doritos and snacks we needed for the road. Blame all of the semis that kept trapping us between them, condensing the prolonged horror show that is my life into an incomprehensible flash before my eyes. Please also blame my closet for being disorganized and not having any fancy clothes in it. They were already at the altar reciting their vows as we snuck into the back of the church. Amy and the gym shoes she hadn't thought to bring, or didn't own, an alternate for, and me in bare feet so my heels wouldn't click on the hardwood floors. And while that definitely made me feel like a jerk, I was also kind of relieved and hoping that we'd miss some of the boring, what is the meaning of love parts. Anyway, I tried to inconspicuously scan the room to see if any black people other than myself were in attendance. Defense mechanism, we all do it. And my eyes locked instantly with those of a black woman a few pews over from ours. And she was glaring at me like I'd stolen her fucking bike. I was all ready to breathe a sigh of relief, and homegirl over here was scowling like I'd taken the last piece of chicken off the buffet. Can you even believe that bullshit? Doesn't she know the unspoken rule that all black people have to stick together within large white gatherings? You never know when a lynch mob might be forming next to the cupcake table. Maybe it was because I was wearing sunglasses indoors, or maybe she's a real stickler for punctuality, but rather than give her the benefit of the doubt, I instead hissed and bared my fangs, which is international black code for, I would never light your path to the Underground Railroad. I let her stare a hole into the side of my face as I shifted my attention to the bridesmaids, who looked absolutely perfect. Combed and sprayed and cinched and plucked, and no unlucky fat friend ruining the uniformity of the bridesmaid roster. Man, I have been that bitch before and I hate it, and it sucks. Can I just sit in the last pew and undo the top button on my expensive outside pants and make eyes at all the bride's single uncles? Why you gotta shove me into this tight and shiny shit? You knew I wasn't going to lose 50 pounds, you asshole, especially because you're incessant calling and emailing me all hours of the day about the florist and the caterer and the dressmaker caused me to stress eat like you would not fucking believe. Would it have killed you to pick a nice jersey or cotton poly blend? My eyelashes are sweating in this cheap-ass dress, and my tits are exploding out of the top like biscuit dough from a can. I was in a wedding once in which every other bridesmaid was 5'2" and approximately 32 pounds, and they all looked gorgeous and toned, and please keep in mind that I do not shave my armpits. I only went because the bride had a cousin I was interested in, but I ended up looking like some sort of mythical creature, all giant and hunched over and tucking my T-Rex arms into my sides so I wouldn't mess up the pictures with my mossy pits. It was a fail, believe me. After the humiliating amateur photo shoot, on the count of three, everybody jump. I threw my Spanx in a trash can at the hotel, put on a hoodie, and took off my pinching shoes before they had even served the salad course. The service was lovely and brief, praises be to the Most High God, and the only blemish on the whole thing was that the minister spaced on the words to the Lord's Prayer as she was reciting it. Holy crap! I'm the biggest sodomite this side of Gomorrah, and even I know all the words to the Apostles' Creed, the 23rd Psalm, and the Lord's Prayer. Don't they teach you that on the first day of Ministry 101? Lesson 1, skimming the collection plate. Lesson 2, Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Blah, blah, daily bread. Blah, blah, trespasses. Amen. I was saying it along in my head with her, feeling pure and clean and washed in the blood of the Lamb. And when she flubbed the line, my first thought was, well, Sam, it's obvious you're the devil and that Jesus really was watching when you let that kid finger you in the laundry room of his apartment building freshman year. Give it up, dummy. But then I realized that she was the wrong one, and now I found the loophole through which I'm going to slip into heaven come judgment day. Like God is Judge Mathis. The wedding was at 4 and the reception at 6:30, and the minute we walked outside to stand broiling under the summer sun and wave ribbons at the happy couple as they descended the steps of the church, I turned to Amy and was like, dude, we have 2 hours to kill in the redacted suburbs. Now, if Janessa hadn't been turning her nose up at me in the church, I would have asked her and Marquise if they wanted to team up and find some place to day drink. But by the time I took my ass off my shoulders and thought about inviting them along on whatever adventure we were